Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Today is a special commemorative program on the work of Mahatma Gandhi on the 66th anniversary of his assassination back in 1948, January 30th. My guest during this program today will be Tushar Gandhi. And Tushar is the great-grandson of Gandhi, regarded as the father of Indian nationalism and the most renowned voice for nonviolent activism for bringing about peaceful democratic social change. Tushar is a social and peace activist, an artist, and an author. He runs the Mahatma Gandhi Foundation in Mumbai, which is dedicated to spreading Gandhian values and principles to address the challenges and threats facing humanity in our contemporary world, and whose president is film director Lord Attenborough. He's also the chairman of the Australian Indian Rural Development Foundation and is involved in projects to prevent child trafficking and is an ambassador of an intergovernmental institute to promote the use of microalgae, spirulina, as a nutritional source to fight malnutrition. He is the author of Let's Kill Gandhi, a chronicle of his last days, the conspiracy, murder, investigation, and trial. Now, so we're going over to India now to say hello to Tushar Gandhi. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with all of you and with your listeners. Thank you very much.
Over the past 30 years, we've observed a rise in fundamentalist Hindu nationalism that also parallels India's modernization through globalization. Now, the major nationalist movement in the Sangh Parivar, which includes extremist groups and political parties such as the RSS, which Gandhi's assassin was likely associated with, as well as one of today's largest political parties, the BJP. Now, this body of organizations over the years has continuously attempted to rewrite the history of Gandhi's death. Not only is the leader of the RSS regarded as a hero among these parties and organizations, but even Gandhi's assassin is praised as a martyr. So take your time and explain to us the forces of Hindu extremism that your great-grandfather had to confront while leading his nonviolent movement for independence. And who was this assassin? Tell us more about the radical ideology he belonged to, the upper caste Brahmins who supported that ideology, and how we in the West, even those of us who grew up in the 60s reading your great-grandfather's work, we believe that there was a lone, crazed assassin. But what you've done is you have challenged that with methodical research, and you're now giving us a story that we haven't heard before in the West. So please take your time and lay out all the steps, the cast of characters, so we can better understand the truth.
Well, the truth is that the apparent reason cited by Bapu's murderer, and I don't like to call him an assassin because I think calling someone an assassin gives him a kind of a justification. His was a plain and simple murder, vicious, brutal, savage, and premeditated murder. There were no doubt in my mind about it. It was an ideology which clashed with the ideology of Gandhi, and the reason why he was murdered was because he believed in creating a society without caste hierarchies. He believed that India could only survive as a nation if everyone, every citizen of India was on the same plane, and nobody was in a vertically high, elevated, escalated, and empowered position. Whereas the RSS, which was a fundamentalist Hindu supremacist organization, believed in its core principle, believed that the upper castes, the Brahmins, were ordained to rule, and to were you know were God's chosen ones to be the leaders of people and nation, and everyone else had to be subjugated to them. And they hated Gandhi because he succeeded to a certain extent in creating a society which was more equal than what India had experienced before him. And so that hatred was so vicious and so brutal that it inspired the murderer, prepared him and equipped him to carry out the murder of Mahatma Gandhi. Nathuram Vinayak Godse, the young man chosen to be the weapon of execution, was from amongst their ranks. He was indoctrinated in that ideology. He believed in the supremacism of the Brahminical order, and he was indoctrinated and completely brainwashed by the ideology of Savarkar, who was the ideologue of Hindu supremacist belief, who believed in this kind of a principle of caste supremacy being the rightful ruler of India, which was completely negated by Bapu. And for that, he was hated to such an extent that people from those organizations actually pasted his photographs in their footwear as a mark of insult to him. And several attempts were made on his life before the final attempt on 30th January succeeded. And in all of them, the city which was the fountainhead of the Hindu Mahasabha, RSS combined, Pune, was involved. And in quite a few of them, his ultimate murderer, Nathuram Godse, and his group of fanatics were recorded to be involved in. And at that time, there was no question of Pakistan or the partition of India or none of that sort. These attempts started, the known ones started right from the 1930s, the mid-30s, when actually Bapu was going around India emancipating the untouchables, opening temples for them making them gaining them access to the wells of the upper caste so that they could get potable drinking water. And you know, basics of life were made available to him, and they were no longer treated as animals. And the attempts on his life from this group of people started exactly with that period of his life. And so it makes me believe that finally they found an excuse which was populist, but their real motive was to avenge the fact that Gandhi created an India where, to a large extent, caste could not dominate the politics of India.
I appreciate the depth of that, but I'd like to pull back for a moment and have us understand the caste system, the segregation, the kind of ethnic apartheid that has existed for a long time in India, and yet it's called the largest democracy in the world. Well, how can you have real democracy when certain groups of people, simply because of where they were born, into what family, what caste they were born, are not considered equal? Some will never be given the jobs or opportunities other will. Some will be shunned. And along comes Gandhi, and he starts to challenge some of these and even discuss the idea that a man, an older man, a senior citizen, could get a young girl as his bride. Then when he died, it was expected that the bride would die at the same time. She would be immolated. She'd be put on his, you know, put on his funeral barge and burned to death. And he went after that. And he did a lot of things that upset the rulers of the caste system because he was very much a feminist, and that was at a time when feminism had no place in Indian culture. So take us through the caste system so we better understand why these Brahmins, why the most powerful religious leaders in India could feel such contempt for him?
Well, you see, the caste system originated from the classification of society according to the profession of the people. Initially, it was thus that the profession of a person put him or her in a certain caste. And initially, there was an ability for people to evolve and get out of those castes, and with the dint of their education and knowledge and experience, move into the other caste, which were all profession-based. They were preachers, they were priests, they were warriors, they were artisans, and then they were the menial workers. But it was more egalitarian, and there was a possibility of immigrating from caste to caste, either going up or coming down according to one's ability. Sometime in prehistory, they discovered that more upper caste people were slipping into the lower caste, and more lower caste people, because they were hungry to better themselves, were empowering themselves and equipping themselves to immigrate into the other castes. And so they came together and evolved a new code which said that caste would be determined by birth, and no matter how capable or able one was, you were condemned to live in that existence. And then the lowest of the low castes were not even treated as human beings. And so the reformist movements that came into Hinduism, although they were microscopic and small and regional in their existence, first attacked this discrepancy in Hindu society and had to bear the wrath of the upper castes, who were entrenched and who were bigoted enough to believe that they were God's gift to humanity, and so they needed to be treated with that kind of respect. With Bapu, this reformist movement, and when I say Bapu, I mean Mahatma Gandhi, my great-grandfather, because for me, referring to him as Gandhi is very impersonal, and so I prefer to call him by the family name of Bapu, or father, or grandfather. And so with Bapu, the movement of reform became populist and far-reaching. It became nationwide. And at that same time, along with Bapu came Baba Saheb Ambedkar, who was from within the caste of untouchables, who bettered himself, educated himself, and then fought for the emancipation, legal emancipation of his people. And so these two events happened together. And Bapu was signaled out by these bigoted, and I won't brand the entire Brahmin community as being guilty of that, but a majority of them were of that bent of mind and of, harbored such bigoted views. And for them, having to see and suffer, as they believed, the change within society was unacceptable. They felt, and there was another grievance also, because the last kingdom in India that fell to the British was the Maratha kingdom, which was then ruled by the Brahmins, the only kingdom ruled by non-warrior caste, the Brahmins. And so they assumed that when the British were ready to leave India and grant freedom to it, or grant the Indian people the right to rule again, they would but naturally come back to the last rulers they had displaced, who were the Brahmin, Maratha Brahmins of Pune, Maharashtrian Brahmins of Pune. And so with Bapu's movement, where he sowed the seeds of an empowered democracy, they again saw that dream being shattered too, because when the British handed over power, it was to a democratic and casteless coalition of the Congress. And so that dream was also shattered. Their last hope of creating an India which would be dominated by the caste equations, which would be dominated by the upper castes and exclusive to the upper caste, was shattered. And so the princes and the Brahmins, groups of Brahmins, were inimicable to let this happen without exacting revenge for that. And the victim of their revenge was Bhakti.
Take us through, if you would, please. Again, let's put a few more pieces of this puzzle together. You're so intimately familiar with it. We are not. We're looking at India through your eyes at that time, not today.
Yeah.
What would have been like in the major cities? What would have been the, let's say, the acknowledgement of one person to another? Did they acknowledge each other based upon their caste system? Did they acknowledge each other based upon their humanity? Did they not acknowledge each other? Did they stay away from people that weren't in their same system? How severe were the lines, the third rail of separatism? How extreme was it? Like a gated community in Connecticut today, where if you're not a billionaire, you know, the police are going to stop you for walking down the public street, the common street, in front of their mansion? How was it?
When Bapu was young and growing up, I'll give you situations from that time. The lowest of the low castes, the untouchables as they were referred to, were treated worse than animals. It was considered that even if their shadow fell on an upper caste Indian, that upper caste Indian would get polluted. And so in many places, in towns and villages, those from those castes used to wear bells around their necks so that when they walked, the bell would ring and warn people that an untouchable was passing by. And so, people would just hurry away or shoo him or her away from their path. So these were extremes. There was no social interaction between the castes. There were exceptions. There were exceptions of people who did not believe in these kind of taboos, but by and large there was very distinct segregation of the castes, which is there even today. There was a recent case of a girl who was condemned to be gang raped because she had the audacity of falling in love with a man from another caste. And so her caste council got together and decided that the punishment was that she would suffer two nights of gang rape. And this happened just a couple of weeks ago. And this is the caste segregation and prejudice at work even today. It is small, it is minuscule in proportion to the population that we have, but it still happens. You know, for the girl who had to suffer that indignity, it is as bad as if she was hounded for her whole life for being an outcast. And so those prejudices still remain, the divisions still remain. Now our homegrown politicians exploit those prejudices and in that way sort of compromise the democratic fabric of India by manipulating election results through caste-based formulas.
Gandhi was known as one of the leading supporters of women's rights. In fact, many of the rights that Indians have today, Indian women have today, and laws, is because of what he brought to the public's attention just during his time, but also some of the reformers after he was killed. Talk about what it was like to be a woman, what were your rights and non-rights before Gandhi started his campaign, during it, and then subsequent to that, not just for women overall, but because it's such a strongly divided system. But what could a woman in the upper class do versus the untouchables do? What were they allowed to participate in or not? So we can see how dire the situation is, because Gandhi alienated a lot of religious people who didn't believe that women had any rights whatsoever. And that is something they would have taken viscerally, almost primally, that he should be opposed or destroyed. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, I think it was very clear. Women were just above the untouchables in the Orthodox society. They were considered to be someone who was needed for reproduction and for managing the household, and nothing beyond that. And so for a long time, they were treated like chattel. There used to be sayings that a girl or a woman is like a cow. You go and tie her to whichever house you wish, and they'll serve that house. And that was the only status they had. But much before Bapu, much before he came, during the time of the British and even before that, there were instances where reformists empowered women and ensured that they got their rightful place and the kind of position they required. It was, again, as I say, it was minuscule, flash in the pan thing. As you said previously, there was the abhorrent practice of widow immolation on her husband's pyre, which of course Raja Ram Mohan Roy got the British to outlaw, and you know, fought a raging battle to see that that practice ended. It still sometimes happens, horrifies the nation, but it still sometimes does happen in certain societies, but not as a practice anymore. But when Bapu took leadership, he believed, right from his days in South Africa, he believed that women were equal to men as in the evolution of society and its well-being. And so he always respected women for their individualities and roles beyond what was considered to be the role of a female in that time. He was the one who brought them into the freedom movement. Initially, he was hesitant to bring them into the freedom movement. When he went on his salt march, he refused to allow women to accompany him. And there was a lot of anger against him. A lot of women were annoyed by that decision that he took. And they challenged him and even called him a male chauvinist. But he explained at that time that he believed that the British administration would come down strongly and brutally against his people who were joining him in that satyagraha, that battle for freedom. And he said, I didn't want to give them an excuse to say that just because Gandhi shielded him with women, we could not administer the kind of the treatment that we had in mind for him. And he says, I will not give them that excuse, and so I'm not going to allow women to join me in this movement as yet. But after breaking the salt law, he invited women from all over India to come to him, and he gave them the duties of what they should be doing in ensuring that the freedom of India came and the ideal freedom of India came. And so the women were brought into the forefront of the freedom movement, and some of the his close associates and people who he banked on to ensure that his message was taken to the people and his battles were efficiently led were women. Sarojini Naidu, Rajkumari Amritkar, and hundreds of those kind of women. And women happily walked out of their families and performed their civil duties according to the orders given by Bapu. And from then on, from the 30s onwards, the freedom movement became truly a movement of not only challenging the British, but also challenging the main male-dominant Indian society till then into accepting that, yes, women had a responsibility that was beyond home and hearth.
Could you, thank you for that. And if you're just joining us, I'm Gary Nall. And on Skype, that's why there's a little echoey sound, and I'm sorry for the technical quality, but the information is superb, is the great-grandson of Gandhi, Tushar Gandhi. And we've already interviewed his father, and Vandana Shiva, in a special on the commemoration of Gandhi's death 66 years ago, on January 30th, 1948. What we're asking today is not just about the assassination per se, but looking at the larger social, political, and religious context in which this could have happened. What would have been the motives? Why would someone have been so against him? Because we, who grew up in, as part of the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, we cherish Gandhi. I don't know a single person that I grew up with hadn't read Gandhi's writings. But what we didn't know is we didn't know what we're being told now. The enormous amount of hatred by those who felt it was their right when the British left, as Tushar has said, they believe since they were the last dynasty before the British took over, they should resume their dynastic movement once the British left. And now they weren't in that power. And then along comes a person who is a populist, who recognizes the importance of women, does not recognize the legitimacy of a caste system, challenges the excesses, including of those most powerful. Well, just imagine what that would have meant. And to the people against him, and they were formidable. He was formidable in his character, but he was not. He didn't have the kind of protection. So now I want to go from there, though I do have some more questions about Gandhi's immediate children and the role they played and what subsequently happened to Indira Gandhi and others who tried to reform and the ultra-Orthodox zealots and the very powerful cooperating and conspiring in her death. But let's go back now, because here are some issues that I'm not settled with. One of the questions that remain to me is why Gandhi's security was so weak on the day of his assassination. Now, just you said that there were two attempts. Well, one of those attempts was 10 days earlier on January 20th. There was a dirty bomb exploded in an assembly where Gandhi was speaking, and that was the fourth attempt on Gandhi's life and also involved his killer. The man you say isn't an assassin, he is a murderer. And then along with six other associates. Then there was an earlier assassination attempt in 1944 when a small crowd approached Gandhi, and again this same murderer, who ultimately killed him, rushed towards Gandhi with a dagger before being restrained. So here we have two prior attempts on Gandhi's life with the same group of individuals involved. And like the assassination of JFK and Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, the official position is that a crazed lone killer was responsible, and therefore there was no conspiracy, which a conspiracy requires two or more persons involved. So when we speak of conspiracies, we mean that things are not what they appear to be on the surface. There remain hidden underpinnings of peculiar activity or unusual changes to what would be standard protocol or expected behavior. So please fill this gap in for us, if you would. What have you uncovered about unusual activities on the days before and on the day of Gandhi's murder?
Look, the fact is that there was a nationwide conspiracy, a far-reaching conspiracy, because just the fact that the killer, for 2 days previous to the murder, till 28th of January, did not have a gun with which to kill Babu. He and his associates traveled across India to try and procure a gun which was efficient enough to murder Bapu with, and they only got it on the evening of the 28th of January, which I believe is referred to as the fascist special in Europe. And this was procured from the Principality of Gwalior. Now, an assassin from Pune, which is in southwestern India, travels across to eastern central India, goes to Delhi, goes across to eastern central India, which is Gwalior, procures this gun, comes back to Delhi, and effects the murder of the Mahatma. And I think it's too unbelievable to think that it was an individual's effort for so many things to fall in place in such a concerted manner. And so the fact is that finally, and the system also heaved a sigh of relief because they had a murderer caught red-handed, and so you know, they could execute their vengeance by the capital punishment enforced on the killer, and so there was no need of going on a witch hunt. But there was a need for going on a witch hunt because there was a deep-rooted conspiracy, which was not only a conspiracy to get rid of the irritant of Gandhi, but to destabilize the infant Indian democracy as it was taking root, as it was strengthening itself, and to ensure that the chaos that we now see in Pakistan was repeated in India too. And this was the conspiracy that finally, if you look at it, Gandhi's murder stalled and destroyed, because the government that was bungling with the protection of Gandhi or the uncovering of the conspiracy acted very sternly after the murder and ensured that the fallout of the murder did not have far-reaching consequences. Now, if you look at the police record, the police keep whining about the fact that they never believed that the killers, who had failed in an attempt just 10 days previously, would have the audacity to come back to the same spot and employ almost the same modus operandi and murder Gandhi. They said, how could they have come back so early? How could we have known that they would come back so early? Right? They had information about clues about the identity of the people. They had clues about the conspiracy being nationwide. They had clues about the role of the organizations that were behind this conspiracy. They kept saying, look, nobody can come back so fast, so we have time to unearth the conspiracy and get rid of the culprits. The apprehension of being caught was there in the minds of the murderers, because on the day of the murder, both Godse, the murderer, and his accomplice, Apte, individually did a recce of Birla House, not with the intention of finding the best way to get to Gandhi, but with the apprehension that there might be policemen from their cities positioned at Birla House who would be able to identify them on sight. And so if they landed up there in the evening, they might get caught before they reached Gandhi. And to their delight, they discovered that there was nobody from those two cities posted at the Birla House who would have known these two people to be troublemakers from Pune and may have prevented that murder that day. Dapu made it very difficult for the conventional security methods to be adopted, but that was expected of him. He would not have entrusted or created a situation where people coming to meet him and people coming especially to his prayer meetings would have to face any kind of encumbrance or irritant. And so he refused to allow the police to frisk the people who were coming into the prayer meetings. But security is not granted to a person according to his or her wish. There are certain rules, there are certain strategies, there are certain blueprints of how people are to be provided security and given a kind of situation where it would be difficult. Over here, it felt as if both the officials and the police were more working towards making it easy to kill Gandhi than working towards making it difficult for the killers to reach Gandhi.
Was there a specific reason why Gandhi was not rushed to a hospital after he was shot 3 times in the chest and instead taken to Birla House, where, as you said, he was residing in New Delhi?
Well, he didn't survive too long after being shot in the chest at such close range with 9mm bullets, and all three bullets in his chest, close up to his heart. He didn't survive long. There was no question. He was dead even before they carried him into the room where he was staying in Birla House. So I don't think that would have mattered. There were two doctors in attendance at the Birla House. If there was any possibility of him being saved or there was any sign of life when they got to him within a period of 3 or 4 minutes after he was shot. I think they would have done something. When Sardar Patel, the Home Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister of India, reached, who was the first of the leaders to arrive at Birla House on hearing the news of the murder, he felt Bapu's hand and he felt as if he heard a faint throb of a pulse. And so he immediately called out to the doctor and said, I think there is a pulse. Please check and see if you can save Gandhi. The doctor checked, gave him a thorough examination again, and even put a stethoscope to find if there was even a faint pulse in his body. There was none. And so I don't think there was medical negligence in providing him any medical help for saving his life. It was beyond them. Two of the bullets went through and through him, and the exit wounds were pretty horrible and big, and the bleeding was excessive. There was where he fell, the ground on which he fell was soaked with his blood, and the people who were there at the prayer meeting were in their grief. They picked up fists full of the blood-stained earth and carried it away with them, resulting that there was almost a 2-foot deep hole at the spot where he fell. In a sad corollary to that, 6 months back, a fistful of that blood-soaked soil was auctioned in England. Somebody who had possession of it put it up for sale, and it fetched that person, I think, about £40,000 for that fistful of soil soaked with Bapu's blood.
There are questions remaining about the partition and creation of Pakistan, which Gandhi went along with, as a possible motive for his assassination. How important is that argument? Does it have any validity? And also, while the British were certainly not completely out of the picture in 1948, is there any evidence of British influence or support behind the assassination?
Not in 48, but this was the group of people, this was the group of fanatics who, when Congress refused to support the British war effort in the Second World War, stood behind Britain and pledged their support to the British war effort and did whatever they could to, just like Jinnah, who also with his Muslim League declared his support for the British war effort. And so these were two groups to which the British were indebted. And so if you look at the process of independence, you will see from time to time that the British actually favored the Muslim League and also in a certain manner the Hindu fanatic wing led by Savarkar. And so in 48, no, they were not hand in glove with these people. But the fact that these people were powerful enough to attempt such a big conspiracy and execute it was the fact that they were patronized, they were given official patronage and made sufficiently strong enough to attempt and get away with this kind of thing, except for Nathuram Godse, who was a mere tool, a mere weapon in the hands of the powerful. Well, the powerful never got punished. They were let off. They were let off, never prosecuted, never investigated. And when they were investigated, the result of the investigation was zilch.
One of the groups of Indians you have targeted as responsible for the support and planning of your great-grandfather's death is the ruling Brahmin families of Pune. Today, we might equate the Brahmins as being similar to our ruling corporate elite in some ways, since they were the caste with the power and influence over activities in the cities and towns. They would have been the puppet masters in a way over local law enforcement and businesses. So who were these Brahmins, and why was Gandhi perceived as such a threat to their higher Hindu caste? Them specifically, you gave us an answer earlier, which we certainly understand, but these are the groups that seem to have taken upon themselves to what they considered unacceptable wrong.
Mm-hmm. But these were the people who were bigoted in their belief. They were from the extremely morbid orthodoxy, akin to the belief of the white supremacists in the South, in the U.S., who believed that they were God, they had God-given right to enslave people whom they considered to be inferior to themselves in way, by the criteria of race. And so was this group of bigots in India who considered that they were the gods chosen to rule the destiny of India. And for them, anything that negated that belief or challenged that belief or destroyed that possibility was public enemy number one. And Bapu was referred to by the choicest of abuse. He was always called the enemy of Hinduism. Surprisingly, he was one of the most devout of Hindus who believed in the essence of Hinduism, who practiced the essence of Hinduism, which was of peace and camaraderie and equality. And yet these bigots branded him the public enemy number one of Hinduism. They justified his murder as saying that it had to be done to protect Hinduism, and they called him the enemy number one of Hinduism. And even today, till today, the campaign in those circles is that Nathuram Godse was the greatest patriot who had to do his duty by his religion by killing, and they refer to his killing, Bapu's killing, murder, as slaying. The biblical term slaying, where the demon was slain, slayed by the forces of good. And so they use that equivalent term in Sanskrit for slaying. They refer to his murder as slaying. And that shows their mentality. That shows that they believe that what they did was performing a religious duty that they had to do it to protect the religion that they believed in. And they did. They were protecting the religion that they believed in, a religion that was bigoted, a religion that was a version of the religion that was bigoted, the version of a religion that was discriminated, a version of a religion that was supremacist and isolationist. Everything that could not be sustained in modern times.
During the Kapoor Commission, which investigated the murder of Gandhi, the assassin took full responsibility for his killing Gandhi and refused to implicate his political guru, Savarkar, in the hearings. Now, as a result, he was Savarkar was acquitted, yet he was a man who was earlier behind killings of British parliamentarian figures in the UK, and was given two life sentences for his participation in the extremist revolutionary group known as India House. He was later freed from prison for renouncing his revolutionary activities. His many writings on turning India into a Hindu nation continue to form much of the political basis of nationalistic Hindu parties today. So, were there any peculiarities during the Kapoor Commission and its final rulings that suggest a larger conspiracy was being hidden, or was it simply a matter of accepting Gandhi was dead and this new young nation needed to move forward and leave the past behind?
Well, I think India has a tendency of trying to sweep its obnoxious portions of his history under the carpet. And this was one of the biggest blots on independent India, was the murder of Bapu. And I think once they got their victim, once they got the murderer to punish, the mood said that let's now forget everything else, let's not go on a witch hunt, and let's remain. And then, you know, the belief of one's fate came into play. And by the time Kapoor Commission's conclusions were published, Savarkar was no more. And so, you know, it was as if everybody just wanted there was no will. There was no will to expose this supremacist plot. There was no will to go after these people who were in the process of weakening the nationalistic fabric of India. The idea of the Indian nation was under threat from these people, but there was no will to expose them, discredit them, and marginalize them. And so the monster was left to its own recourse to regroup and emerge stronger. The most reprehensible thing that the government of India did at that point of time was impose a ban on these two organizations. And so they created martyrs out of villains. And that martyrdom and that stigma gained sympathy for them in the generations that were not witness to Bapu and his work. And slowly we have come to this stage where we stare the possibility of one of them becoming the Prime Minister of India and heading the government of India, which would be the greatest danger to humanity and the idea of a pluralistic India.
My final question is, tell us about Gandhi's children, what role they played in carrying on his legacy, and what were the outcomes of their lives?
Well, I think the four sons of Baba and Bapu, they went back, they honored their father's desire that none of his offsprings came into the public limelight merely on the basis of being his offsprings. And so they withdrew from public life and became private individuals who continued to work with some of the organizations that Bapu had founded or was associated with, which were working in the social arena. The next generation, the generation of my father and his cousins, some of them remained in private life, some of them ventured into public life, a life of service, a life of spreading the message of my great-grandfather. And in my generation, although I was never told that I had to do this, I selected this life for myself after understanding my own limitations and understanding the need to propagate the ideals of my great-grandfather in society today. And so I have taken up that work. My cousins, they are all over the world in their own private lives. We are almost a bunch of 100-plus descendants of Bai and Bapu alive today across the globe, in India and abroad, all over, especially. And I think we're slowly dissolving into becoming general non-privileged Indians. Some of us, I won't say we are not privileged. When our lineage is known, we do get respect, we do get recognition, we do get love. Sometimes we do get favors too. But none of us seeks those favors. None of us wears their lineage on the sleeve. I am an exception because now I get recognized as the great-grandson of the Mahatma, and so it is difficult for me to hide my lineage. I don't believe in hiding it at also. If it does some good, it's good. Otherwise, I don't use it for personal aggrandizement or enrichment. And so I feel that every one of us should perform the duties we consider to be sacred or important enough to do. And so we have inherited that. Some of us are carrying on the legacy, the others are not. And there's no judgment or no judging any one of us. Right. Those who do it voluntarily, those who don't are welcome.
Well, I think you are carrying on your grandfather's legacy because you are a social and peace activist and you are putting yourself out there. A real quick answer, if you would. What would Gandhi think if he looked at India today? Massive, growing, rich on one level, but more poor than almost any other country in the world per population except for China. And the have and have nots are extreme, non-sustainable, out of water, pollution rampant, overcrowding of cities, and a lot of people living in abject destitute conditions. What would he say today?
Well, he would be disgusted, but he would not be disheartened. He would have been working, if he was alive, he would have been working to prevent this eventuality from happening long, long back. Because Bapu never reacted to situations. He always pre-guessed those situations and started working to avoid them much earlier. And so I believe that he would have been continuously working to ensure that we didn't reach the level as a nation or a people that we have reached at the moment. He would certainly, by some coincidence, if he was removed from the scene and brought back today, he would be disgusted at what we have achieved or no, haven't achieved.
I appreciate you giving us your insight. Speaking from Skype from Mumbai, India, is Tushar Gandhi, the great-grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, who we're celebrating, commemorating the 66th anniversary of his assassination on January 30th, 1948, to give a different perspective on him, the people against him, the context in which he lived and died. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening.